For two reasons, we're pleased to welcome you, of course, and Keith Morton this morning. His topic is one reason, the current status and background of the present peace process and talks in the Middle East. He's one of us. He received his PhD at the University of Virginia, and thereby hangs a tale. The debate goes on in every graduate department, I suspect, in the country as to who you should admit, how many you should admit, candidates you should admit, what criteria there should be. And there is a school of thought that you ought to look very carefully at the GPAs and the academic records people have had and restrict it. Yale, for instance, restricted its admission at one time, I'm not sure whether this has changed, to 8 people in their government department. We've adopted a somewhat different philosophy, and those who adhere to this first view always complain, well, we lose sometimes 2 out of 3 of the people who come from big schools and have the highest record. But poets have written about the tortoise and the hare. Advancement in the social sciences especially is often gradual and incremental. The best graduate student at the University of Chicago, when I was there, in terms of his previous record before admission, is now a proofreader in a publishing house in New York. So it's a very uncertain terrain, and this is background to say that Keith Morton, certainly throughout his career, has been a good student, but he's one of the people who has, as his career has progressed, has won prizes such as the Gallatin Prize, received fine recognition as acting assistant professor in the department, had a career that is very often characteristic of people in the international relations field, starting his graduate work, interrupting it to serve in the Peace Corps in Tunisia in the era of Habib Bourguiba, then resuming it again, then interrupting it again to teach at Troy State University in its overseas program, and then completing a very fine dissertation, the length of the title of which requires that I read it, Conflict and Cooperation in the Mediterranean, Implications for the United States. I was on the committee, so I know it's a good dissertation, and his work has continued in this vein. He's a member of a group that 10% of you may be able to recognize, the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, which is a part of the Central Intelligence Agency, has gone through various phases in its development, Foreign Broadcast Monitoring Service, Foreign Intelligence Service, but fundamentally is part of our Central Intelligence Organization. And as others who work as he does, as a Middle East analyst or any other regional analyst, he's developed a great knowledge of his region, of the problems of the region, and therefore we're extremely happy that he is here. He has one other point of distinction. He's one of the few people working in Washington who was born in Washington. He was born in Fort Myers, and as an Army brat. He got his undergraduate degree, by the way, at Brown. So for that long-winded reason, set of reasons, we're very pleased to have a returning native of the University of Virginia.
Thanks very much, Professor Thompson. It's always nice to come to Charlottesville on any occasion, but I especially appreciate the opportunity to keep one foot in the academic community, which is still where I see myself as having my roots. I have a nasty feeling I've got a few more notes than I have time here. I do hope very much that we can have some time at the end for a general discussion, questions, and comments. I'll try to work it out that way. If I rush through some things more quickly than they deserve, please feel free to raise points afterwards. Let me run through a couple disclaimers first. First, the one I'm sure you hear from every government employee, which is simply that I'm here speaking purely for myself, so please do not regard anything that I say as in any way representing official U.S. government opinion or of the CIA or any other part of the government. Secondly, I thought it might be worthwhile to take just a minute to talk a little bit about the nature of my job. Working as a Middle East analyst within the intelligence community, I have fairly broad access to what the U.S. government knows, or at least thinks it knows, about the various parts and issues in the Middle East that are of interest to me. And that is one of the most enjoyable parts of the job, actually, being able to browse through at any time the whole wide range of information that comes into the government. At the same time, some of you might be surprised at how little I know as to what goes on within U.S. policymaking circles, and that's really the point I want to emphasize. Now, in part, that's simply because of the fact that our current Secretary of State, tends to keep things quite close to his chest and not spread things around a lot. But it is also because of a significant institutional distinction made in Washington between what would commonly be called the policymaking community and the analytical community, the analytical community being that of which I am a member. Contrary to popular fiction, or possibly the fondest hopes of William Casey, the CIA does not make U.S. foreign policy, and indeed shouldn't be in that business. The distinction between the two communities is not absolutely rigid and inflexible, but it is nonetheless real. And it exists for the reason that those of us in the analytical community take great pride in the fact that the work we do is supposed to be devoid of any influence, be it explicit or even unrealized, any influence from the wishes or perceptions of policymakers. You may have noticed during the confirmation hearings for Robert Gates a month or two ago how passionate an issue that became, the whole matter of politicization and the division even among the various witnesses for and against him. I raise all of this now just to explain the fact that while I will certainly be talking about U.S. foreign policy here today, I do not come before you as an insider as far as the making of U.S. policy is concerned. Well, in keeping with my mandate then to talk about the background and current status of Middle East negotiations, I've organized my notes around three major questions. First, why are these negotiations occurring? Second, what are the results so far? And third, with a somewhat more hesitation, what are the future prospects? First then, why are these negotiations occurring? Or a bit more specifically, why are they occurring now, when there seems to be so little visible sign of progress in narrowing the deep substantive differences between Arabs and Israelis? It's worth noting that even within the last few years, several quite genuine, quite serious U.S. initiatives have nonetheless failed to get off the ground. George Shultz tried in roughly the last year of the Reagan administration and made very little headway. Secretary Baker himself tried during approximately the first year of the Bush administration, starting in 1989. The effort staggered into 1990 without seeming to get very far before being eclipsed by the Gulf crisis. Even the current U.S. initiative, you may remember, initially seemed to be making very little progress. Both Israel and Syria essentially rejected it in May. We were not really able to break the procedural logjam until midsummer, and it was not until that point that we even seemed to have much chance of getting anything started. Well, the simplest and most obvious answer to my first question, but I think a good place to start, is that we are seeing these current negotiations because the Bush administration very much wanted them to occur. I think it's become clear that President Bush is very strongly committed, perhaps more than any previous U.S. president, to achieving some kind of an Arab-Israeli solution, and I assume this will continue to be the case for as long as he holds office. I want a little bit later to come back to a more detailed look at the diplomatic strategy, which I think the U.S. has been adopting throughout this process. For the moment, it is simply worth noting and keeping in mind that nothing of what has happened thus far could possibly have happened without the United States. Now, let me move on to a more specific answer to my first general question as to why these negotiations are occurring now. I think that both United States and indeed Middle East decision makers have perceived at this present time unique circumstances, which, depending on which actor you're talking about, have either provided the opportunity to initiate serious negotiations, or alternatively, at least the obligation for actors in the region to respond to such initiatives, whether they really welcome them or not. Two well-known factors have basically been responsible for these changed circumstances. First, as we're all aware, the historic change in East-West relations. Within the Middle East, this has meant a couple things. First of all, for almost the first time in its history, the Arab-Israeli conflict is now free of Cold War complications. Secondly, along with that, the fact that with the collapse, or whatever one wishes to call it, of the Soviet Union, the United States is now widely perceived in the Middle East as, and one sees this phrase constantly, the world's only superpower. And that means one whose wishes simply cannot be ignored or toyed with. Perhaps, just as a quick aside, if there was any one really dramatic indication of this, was President Gorbachev's opening speech at the Madrid conference, if you saw that. He wound up talking mostly about internal Soviet problems. It was, at least to us, really striking. He all but implicitly acknowledged that the Soviet Union really was no longer going to be a leading actor in this process, even though it would try to help out. Now, the second broad circumstance that I referred to was obviously the outcome of the Gulf crisis. Clearly, this reinforced the perception of nations within the region, of the United States, as really the only dominant external force in the region. Across the board, Middle East governments, whether they welcomed U.S. activity during the Gulf crisis or opposed it, nonetheless were impressed not only, of course, by the demonstration of raw military power, but just as much by the obvious U.S. determination to see this thing through to the end. Frequently within the region, again, among either our friends or foes, there has been the perception that U.S. Middle Eastern policy is very inconstant, and that either we cannot be relied upon, or alternatively, one need not worry too much about any specific U.S. Middle Eastern initiative, because probably it won't last very long, and before long our attention will be diverted to something else. Clearly that impression began to change significantly as a result of the Gulf crisis. Among those nations in the region who welcome active U.S. involvement in seeking an Arab-Israeli solution, there was, I think, considerable encouragement from the ability of the Bush administration to form and lead this quite large and diverse Gulf coalition during the crisis, and a real sense of hope that the U.S. would now devote equal attention to the entire Palestinian-Arab-Israeli problem. Let me now turn to applying these broad factors I've just talked about to the major regional actors in these current negotiations. And let me start with the two, Syria and the Palestinians, in whom I think U.S. policymakers thought that as a result of the changed circumstances in the region, there was a real chance for a major change of attitude and policy toward Arab-Israeli negotiations that might give us, to use the favorite phrase in Washington, a window of opportunity to make progress. First, then, Syria. Syria, I think, is the clearest and simplest example of the impact of these global and regional changes that I talked about. You might recall, if you've been following the history of this initiative, that it was Syrian acceptance of the U.S. proposal in mid-July, following a personal appeal from President Bush, that really broke the logjam and got things rolling. This notwithstanding the fact that Syria had previously commonly been known as one of the very hard-line governments in the Middle East when it came to Arab-Israeli matters. In looking at the reasons, then, for this change in Syrian policy, I think if I might first make a slight aside, it's interesting to note that the Syrian government, from a purely analytical sense, is, to me, perhaps the most interesting of any of the Arab governments. That for the reason that behind the ideological facade, which it still maintains, I think the Syrian regime is perhaps the most pragmatic to be found in the Arab world. I should explain that pragmatic doesn't necessarily mean wise, it doesn't necessarily mean prudent, it certainly doesn't necessarily mean democratic or humanitarian. Specifically, Syrian policy on Arab-Israeli matters is still affected by, first of all, a profound suspicion of Israel, a considerable suspicion of the United States, and certainly not inconsiderable suspicion of other Arab governments as well, whom Syria constantly fears could get together and reach some kind of a settlement with Israel over Syria's own interests. Nonetheless, it seems to me that the Syrian regime, among certainly the hardline governments so-called, has perhaps the fewest psychological hurdles to overcome when it reaches the conclusion that in its own self-interest, a change of policy is necessary. We can see some evidence of this even in previous years in Syrian government action, when they can be simultaneously, if not supporting, certainly tacitly encouraging terrorist activity against Israel from out of southern Lebanon, while at the same time working very hard and very seriously with us to try to resolve the Western hostage crisis in Lebanon. For the Syrians, they have no problem at all in, on the surface, seemingly engaging in what looks like contradictory sorts of diplomatic activities. So clearly in the Syrian case, this change of policy over the summer was a result of what I think in the political scientist sense would be called a rational calculation of where Syrian interests now lay. Most significantly, Syria's traditional patron, the Soviet Union, was simply no longer in the picture. Syria had always been heavily dependent on Soviet support. It was no longer there even before last summer and even before the coup and subsequent events. The Soviets had made it quite plain privately to the Syrians that they could no longer count on Soviet largesse, and perhaps the time had come for the Syrians to start rethinking their own policies in the Middle East as a result. Secondly, linked to this, Syria benefited significantly from its participation in the Gulf Coalition against Iraq, notwithstanding the fact that, as far as we can tell, there was a significant degree of internal opposition. Nonetheless, Syria saw this, quite accurately, I think, as an opportunity to move out of the increasing isolation in the international community and the Arab world into which it had fallen, and it was successful. The Syrians realized very tangible benefits to this, and I think their decision over the summer was largely based on the calculation that this was something they had to do in order to continue this process of finding new sources of support and avoiding isolation. Clearly, also, U.S. policymakers base their hopes in the case of Syria on these same assumptions. Let me move on now to the Palestinians. I should say, first of all, this, in fact, is the topic on which I spend most of my own time at the office, and so I'm always tempted to talk about the most. They are also the most complicated actors to talk about. Broadly speaking, the Palestinians, too, were forced to undertake a fairly significant change in their attitude toward U.S. Middle East peacemaking efforts. And here, too, this was something that U.S. policymakers, I think, clearly anticipated and counted upon. I want to focus on just two broad factors in the case of the Palestinians. First of all, the fact that the Palestinian movement came out of the Gulf crisis gravely weakened. I don't think I have time here to go into a lot of the background on this. I think certainly the PLO's position during the Gulf crisis was in many respects misunderstood, but that is not to say that they did not commit catastrophic errors for which they are still paying the price. Broadly speaking, the PLO's alignment against the Gulf coalition during the crisis was based on an atypical and quite grave miscalculation on their part that tensions emanating from the Gulf crisis could be exploited to the advantage of the Palestinians' own cause. Specifically, that the international community, especially the United States, would be forced to support Palestinian demands in order to preserve their other interests in the region. I raise this to lead into a matter which is still of importance, and that is, in the case of the PLO, the continuing very paradoxical attitude which the mainstream PLO leadership adopts toward the United States. By way of definition, by mainstream PLO leadership, I mean essentially Yasser Arafat, his fairly narrow circle of advisors, and those within the broader organization who support them. This paradoxical attitude is based upon the fact that the mainstream PLO leadership has for a long time accepted that they have to have significant, substantial U.S. involvement in a Middle Eastern peace process if Palestinians have any hope of achieving any of their own nationalist aspirations. Indeed, this hope leads, in some cases, to false expectations on the part of at least traditional mainstream PLO leaders. Virtually any one of them at any time is ready at the drop of a hat to deliver a learned disquisition on what they refer to as the lessons of the 1956 war, in which they will explain that the United States ordered the United Kingdom, France, Israel to get out of the Sinai Desert, thereby proving that we can just as easily order a solution to all of the current difficulties. And indeed, perhaps unfortunately for some, the outcome of the Gulf crisis only reinforced this general feeling that the solution to the Arab-Israeli crisis will come in the form of a phone call from Washington to Jerusalem. The other side of this paradox, then, as I've just hinted, is that while earnestly desiring an active U.S. role, there is still considerable suspicion and resentment of the United States because of what is perceived of our, in the past, uncritical support of the State of Israel. Early on in the Gulf crisis, for the reasons I just explained, PLO leaders thought they were going to be in the driver's seat with regard to the United States. They thought they were going to be able to force us to bend to their will. Too late, from their perspective, they realized the terrible misjudgment they had occurred and the very grave implications it was going to have for them in the post-Gulf crisis Middle East. Nonetheless, I think it is striking at how quickly the PLO leadership recognized its problem once the crisis was over, recognized the need to swallow its pride, recognized the need to begin restoring its ties with the major Arab governments, Egypt especially, recognize the fact that it would now, for the time being, largely be in the position of supplicant and not demander with regard to the United States, and indeed that if the United States is going to push its initiative, the PLO would have to accept a lot of U.S. demands that certainly contravened the PLO's own demands and that it would never dreamed of accepting earlier. I'm skipping over a lot of history here, but I'm referring to such things as the conditions for these negotiations that they have accepted, such as no international UN-sponsored international conference, no direct PLO role in the negotiations, Palestinian presence in a joint delegation with Jordan, no representatives from East Jerusalem, and one could go on. In fact, despite its blundering during the Gulf crisis, the PLO handled itself fairly adeptly in the run-up to these negotiations. Indeed, on some matters, they achieved some success in extracting some concessions out of us that I think our policymakers didn't quite realize we would have to give to them. Let me move on now quickly to the second major factor in the Palestinian arena. And indeed, I would submit that this is the most important internal development within the Palestinian movement, probably since the formation of the PLO in the 1960s. And that is the real emergence of Palestinian leaders from the occupied territories, especially from the West Bank, as major players within Palestinian political leadership. This, in fact, is not strictly a new phenomenon since the Gulf crisis. It had already begun during the Palestinian uprising, which was largely spontaneously generated within the territories, which raised a lot of hopes and expectations among Palestinians, which initially led to disappointment among Palestinians in the territories over what, for a time, they saw as the failure of the traditional PLO leadership to come up with a coherent strategy to exploit the uprising. Leaders from the territories had already begun to assert themselves before the Gulf crisis. The privately expressed but nonetheless widespread perception among West Bankers that the PLO leadership really botched its handling of the Gulf crisis further extended this process. In the run-up to these current negotiations, the West Bank leadership has emerged as a source of pressure and influence on the PLO leadership to adopt a more flexible, more realistic diplomatic strategy. And indeed, for a variety of reasons, I think it's been clear just watching this process that as a group, the West Bank leaders seem to be much more able, and in fact, it comes to dealing with international public opinion, with the US government, with the diplomatic community in general. The likes of Hana Nashrawi, no doubt benefiting from her UVA PhD. Did anyone ever know her when she was here, by the way? She and I overlapped, and I never met her.
Rui knew her.
Yeah, I never did. I wish I had. The likes of Ashrawi, Faisal Husseini, certainly Dr. Abdel Shafi, the formal head of the Palestinian delegation, are a far cry from Yasser Arafat or his crowd in the PLO. PLO leadership, which perhaps seems so ineffectual in its dealings with the West because of its own history emerging from a long period of intrigue, underground activities, Byzantine internal political maneuvering, stereotypical views of Israel. Leaders from the territories had far fewer psychological hang-ups when it comes to the fact of getting down to the practical grappling with the sort of political and diplomatic issues with which Palestinians are going to have to be dealing in this process. I do want, however, to take one moment to explain what this emerging West Bank leadership is not. And that is, you may have heard this phrase, the famous alternate Palestinian leadership, which has long been a hope of Israel, or at least of Israeli governments. That is, an indigenous Palestinian leadership in the occupied territories, which A, would reject the PLO, 2, would reach an agreement with Israel, essentially on Israel's terms, and 3, could make that agreement stick with the Palestinian community in general. That, as I say, is not what this emerging West Bank leadership is, for several reasons. First, most obviously, because their basic objectives, ultimate Palestinian independence, are absolutely identical with those of the traditional Palestinian leadership. And secondly, because they continue themselves both to recognize the need for unity within the Palestinian movement and to beware of efforts to divide the Palestinians, which has long been an Israeli strategy. And finally, because they, like many Palestinians, still fundamentally continue to regard the PLO as basically their government. That, as I've said, does not mean in any sense that they will always agree with what the PLO leadership does. West Bank leaders have come to assume, have come to demand, and indeed have achieved a major voice of their own in Palestinian decision-making. There is now, in figurative terms, really two poles to the Palestinian movement: Tunis, the traditional PLO leadership, and Jerusalem, the leadership emerging from the territories. And that too is and will continue to be a major factor, whatever the future of this peace process. Turn now to Israel, which privately, perhaps less candidly, was also recognized by U.S. policymakers as a potential sticking point. And in this case, too, I think U.S. policymakers anticipated that the outcome of the Gulf crisis might ease our task in persuading the Israelis to go along with our initiative. It's worth noting that Israel also, like a number of the Arab nations, had resisted a number of the previous U.S. initiatives, including the initial efforts of Secretary Baker. Israel always adhered to its version of the format which Middle East negotiations should follow, that is, direct bilateral negotiations with Israel's neighboring Arab governments. This based essentially on the assumption that through these sorts of negotiations, Israel could basically reach a settlement on its own terms. That is, one without having to make any major territorial compromise, one without having to make any fundamental concessions to Palestinian demands for sovereignty. The hope was that Arab governments, once they could solve their own problems with Israel, would essentially go along with the Israeli notion of Palestinian autonomy, coming out of the Camp David Accords, meaning essentially, though in fact it was never precisely defined, some sort of quite limited self-rule within the Palestinian territories, which would nonetheless ultimately become formally part of the sovereign state of Israel. Well, the impact of the Gulf War upon Israel in general, upon Israeli leaders, is a very interesting and still somewhat unclear issue. In fact, it's one on which I hope we will in future see some scholarly studies coming up. As far as the Arab-Israeli conflict is concerned, the result of the Gulf War, if anything, heightened the debate among, for want of better labels, and I tend not to like labels, hawks and doves within Israel. That is, those who traditionally supported a more flexible Israeli policy on the Palestinian issue, urged Israel to enter in negotiations, saw in the Gulf War a clear lesson that territory no longer meant very much strategically. Even though in a purely military sense, Israel was never really seriously threatened during the Gulf crisis, the specter of Scud missiles coming down randomly without warning was obviously very traumatic. For some in Israel, the lesson was obvious. It was time to change Israel's strategic conception of the Middle East and get on with the business of serious negotiations and reaching a settlement. This, I believe,
like an American interest section in the Italian embassy. Yet, we had absolutely no problem going into Syria. We went by cab to shop in Damascus. The women's club scheduled trips all over. We covered Syria completely. The American Community School children went for a week in the desert with the Bedouins, ate in the desert, etc., etc. We crossed as diplomats, didn't even have to get out of the cab. We could go wherever we pleased, to all the antiquities. Yet, the official, we could not have official contact. So I, as representing Foreign Agricultural Service, could send communications to a Lebanese hydrologist who was an acquaintance of mine, to the Syrian counterparts, and vice versa. It seemed to me that our attitude toward the Syrians invited the Russians in, actually. They would have welcomed our equipment if we had given it to them. They resented being treated as a surrogate. In other words, we going to the Soviet government to communicate with the Syrian government. And so I feel that this is really not a change in the Syrian attitude. They're still a bit gun shy as to what our real position in this equation is.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely, and I think you've described the Syrian position, Major, maybe better than I did. This is part of what I was getting at when I talked about fundamental sense of pragmatism, or even if you like the realpolitik in the Syrian government. They are quite able to come talk to us or just about anybody else if they see the circumstances as favoring them. And I agree with you. I was in the past year, especially since the Gulf crisis. There has been a change in the U.S. approach to Syria. I would even go so far as to say that I think for a while some in Washington may have gotten a bit over enthusiastic. Getting Syria to send that armored division, which mostly sat in the desert and didn't do very much in particular during the war itself, was seen as a tremendous plum for us. We knew pretty much the Egyptians there would be there. Obviously, we knew the Saudis and other Gulf countries would be there. But the Syrians were there. Tilos indicated tangibly that they had succeeded in garnering support from that part of the Arab community with which we frequently had serious difficulties. And of course, you're well aware of our difficulties with Syria over terrorism and hard-line stance on Arab-Israeli issues. Yes, I think there was a change, has been a change in the U.S. attitude, and Syrians combined with the demise, or whatever you wish to call it, of the USSR, has been quite happy to take advantage of that and move in. If not in getting perhaps more direct support from the U.S., they've already collected, if you want to put it in mercenary terms, $2 billion or more from the Saudis with U.S. blessing. In the past, if we go back to 10 or 15 years ago, we would have been screaming bloody murder about that, probably. They're certainly not doing so now.
And their relationship with Lebanon is symbiotic with Lebanon.
I guess I would say paternal, but...
The elite, the Syrian laborers coming in doing all the dirty work, and the Lebanese being the elite governing class, despite the fact of the presence of the Syrian army.
I didn't mention directly the deplorable state of the Syrian economy, which is definitely another factor in the Syrian calculations as to where their interests lie right now.
Next question, Victor Young.
Professor, isn't Lebanon a safe and occupied country?
This is a very complicated and controversial issue, as you well know. I think that is an oversimplification. Plainly, the Syrians believe that they have vital security interests in Lebanon. They did not want Lebanon to fall under the sway either of Israel, but just as much they did not want Lebanon to fall under the sway of any of various and sundry militant Islamic groups, who some fought, perhaps unrealistically so, were moving in the direction of taking over the country at some point. Certainly they damn well didn't want to see Lebanon coming under Iraqi influence. So indeed, the Syrians saw their vital interests as involved. They established a major presence there. Remember, just for the record, they did go there at the invitation of the Arab League in 1976. Certainly in the formal legal sense, it was no invasion. Since the achievement of the Taif Accords, broadly speaking, a program of political reform in Lebanon, which now hopefully seems to mark the end of the the civil war, that does provide for a gradual Syrian military withdrawal from Lebanon. That is starting. I think it will continue. I think the Syrians will adhere to it. The Lebanese government is slowly, not yet completely, reestablishing authority over the country outside of the Beirut area. We used to, privately in our way around the office, around the agency, used to refer to the president of Lebanon, whoever it was at the time, as the mayor of East Beirut. That is beginning to change. So I would prefer to use the term a paternal relationship. That's going to continue. The Lebanese are not going to do anything that they know seriously and directly contradicts Syrian interests. I think this slow reestablishment of Lebanese government authority is real.
Next question.
Yes, George. I have two quick questions. Why was it that the U.S. did not inform Israel of the timing of the Washington meeting, number one? And number two, the Pan Am bombing of the Pan Am plane, the investigation indicated some direct evidence that Libya was involved, which everybody knows, but there was some circumstantial evidence that Syria was also involved. Bush came out the next day and said that circumstantial evidence should not even be considered, and there was some information there that needed to upset Syria at all. Would you comment?
Yeah. First question. As to the matter of the timing of our announcement of the invitations for the next round of talks in Washington, the official explanation is that it was a mistake. I don't believe it myself. If it was, I would certainly expect to see somebody hanging from the State Department flagpole very shortly. I imagine that this is obviously one of the things I don't want to be quoted on coming out of here. I mentioned that coming out of Madrid, and I think I know this to be the case, Secretary Baker was very upset with both the Israelis and the Syrians. His remarks in that closing speech of his, if you recall, addressing the parties in general, that I can't quote it directly, you have not done what you should have done to build confidence and move this process along. He was talking to Israel, he was talking to Syria. I think, and in the intervening couple of weeks, we made absolutely no progress with the Israelis on this matter of venue. We at least thought that for the time being, the Israeli insistence on moving directly to the region was unreasonable and was not something the Israelis should be trying to insist on. I do not have direct evidence of this, for reasons I was explaining at the outset. I believe the Secretary decided basically that he just wasn't going to take much more out of the Israelis on this, and that the only way we were going to prevent continuous foot dragging was, in essence, to try and force this kind of thing on them. I cannot avoid the suspicion that this was a conscious decision. Secondly, on Pan Am 103, two things. This is not a topic I work on directly. And second, I must beg your indulgence in that a lot of the details of this are highly classified, and I'm just prohibited from even talking about what I do know about it. This was an extraordinary investigation, even on the technical level. I'm not a technical expert, but I know some of the details, and it's just fantastic. The extent of the effort put behind it, the kind of technical expertise that went into it.
I was drawing a question.
No, I do want to give an answer. The basic answer is that I think we mean what we say. We now think the Libyans were involved, and the evidence is not adequate to blame the Syrians or the Iranians. That's the short answer. And largely, I think this is based on some of the technical evidence, some of which was not developed into well into the investigation. The one point I wanted to make, and I think this is significant, from the outset, the Bush administration, and I think this came straight from the president, insisted that it wanted the result of this investigation to be evidence that would produce U.S. indictments. They didn't want something that would result in a document saying, we think so-and-so is involved, end of story. They wanted indictments, they wanted a legal case, they wanted to have something we could pursue through international legal channels. I'll tell you what I think we may have stumbled on, and this is largely speculation based on some things I can't talk about. I think it is entirely possible that one of the militant Palestinian factions, which is still harbored within Syria, the PFLP-GC, a breakaway Palestinian faction, may very well have had something like this in mind, and it's certainly consistent with their past behavior. Elements in Iran, I'm inclined to think not the government, but certainly elements in Iran may well have had something like this in mind. I think it's entirely possible that the early phases of the investigation stumbled on to some kind of Iranian PFLP-GC action that in fact never came to fruition. And we had in fact had a simultaneous but mostly distinct conspiracy plot, whatever you wish to call it, coming on out of Libya. That's hypothesis on my part, but I think that may be part of the explanation. I do accept the administration's statement that at present they don't think they have sufficient evidence to blame anybody other than the Libyans.
5 minutes on the murky future.
Murky future. Short term, I'm afraid I am not very optimistic. I will have to condense this. For the moment, I do share what I think to be the administration view that Israel and Syria are going to remain major obstacles. Maybe let's talk for a minute about Israel, because there is one thing to add there. I do think that the Shamir government's approach to this, for now, is entirely defensive. That is, they're primarily concerned with preventing any further erosion, as they see it, in their position. One of the things for now to speculate upon, not a hypothesis, is what might the Israelis do if indeed they see themselves as being in trouble. One of the possibilities, anyhow, is to call early elections. They're not due till next November. In the Israeli parliamentary system, they can be called at any time. Still speculation, it's worth noting that simultaneous with these events with the negotiations, there is quite a real and very serious political crisis going on within Israel over next year's budget. I won't go into the details, but it's a major fight. It's even conceivable that the government might fall on that alone by the end of the month. Probably not. Nonetheless, I can imagine that there are advisors to Shamir who are unhappy about the whole course of the negotiations, who would be whispering in his ear that perhaps it would be wise to use this domestic matter as the occasion to dissolve the government, call elections in that form, bringing the process for the moment to a halt. Syria, for the various reasons I discussed, I won't go on. The Syrians will continue to be very hard-nosed at best. I'm inclined to think that because they fear isolation, they will try to avoid outright walking out of the process, but they are going to continue to be a very stubborn obstacle. Longer term, I don't know, but I do see at least some encouraging developments out of the current process, things that at least I hope are going to continue, and which perhaps could provide a basis for longer term hope. First of all, I'm stepping outside my analyst role here, but I think the more active U.S. role, to me that's vital, it's going to remain vital. I hope it continues. Secondly, further elaboration as I talked about what I believe to be a historic change in Palestinian attitudes and Palestinian political dynamics. I think now there is really a clear consensus among the Palestinian community in general that this process, this diplomatic process, is worth pursuing. Even though they now understand that it's not going to be easy, there are going to be setbacks, they're not going to get everything I want. I think there is a growing perception that despite all of that, it really is in their own interest to take this seriously. Finally, in the case of Israel, I said I made the distinction between the government and Israel as the country, because I think we certainly see in Israel a strong current of opinion favoring what I would call a more realistic or a more official, or what is the word, a more moderate official attitude. Basically, I don't think the status quo is tenable for Israel. I don't think they can hold on to the territories forever. I don't think they can get what the Shamir government gives as its stated objectives for a whole host of political, economic, even moral, cultural, psychological reasons. I think it's beyond Israel's capacity. My hope in the case of Israel, maybe this is a fitting conclusion here at the University of Virginia in a replica of the House of Burgesses, I retain a simple, innocent Jeffersonian faith that in the long term, a democratic society, which Israel certainly is, has the best prospects for achieving a wise decision as what is in its own best interests. Took the Palestinians 40 years. I hope it won't take Israel that long.
Okay. Thank you very much.